To see examples of what we talked about on this episode, along with further information, go to bunchofdorks.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to
Two Dimension Podcast,
the comic book podcast
with no direction.
I'm Don Moore, and you're listening to Two Dimension, the comic book podcast with no direction. And sitting across from me is a man who invents his own reality, and that is...
Al. Yep, that's me. Yeah. I invent my own reality. My world, and, you know, maybe you're welcome to it. I don't know.
Well, you've always invited all of us in. I appreciate it.
Yep.
And last episode, we were talking about Steve Rude, and I'm here to talk about... Nexus, Into the Past, and Other Stories.
This is the ones that Dark Horse Presents.
Yeah. Dark Horse Presents.
A few years ago.
Yeah, Dark Horse Presents is, I guess, an anthology magazine. And this was, they were going to run the Baron and Rude stories in that. I was excited about it until I realized that they were just part of it. They were kind of short stories. And I never bothered with it. And then I found out that they were putting a trade, but, you know, the stories didn't run consecutively. It's like it was in three or four issues of Dark Horse Presents, and then later on they brought a few more stories into Dark Horse Presents. But they tell a continuing narrative of the story. The thing starts off with Nexus is kind of, him and Sandra Peel have a little boy, and most of his time is spent, you know, with them. And, he's not taking many cases. You know, there's a problem going on. Tyrone, the president, shows up and talks to him about it. And he's basically kind of, well, why should I bother with this? You know, you got a military, you got a police force. But then he finds out about it. A lot of things ensue, but the character Claiborne comes back, which was one of the most terrifying characters from way back in the 80s. And it's a time travel story. He ends up... meeting Sherlock Holmes. There's the time machine. H.G. Wells is in it. And I'm like, wow, this is something. It also has his twin daughters, Sheena and... I can't remember the other girl's name. Sheena and Shauna. But, you know, by this time, their mother's gone, the dragon lady, and they're running the empire, the planet Prykon themselves. I don't know. I really enjoyed it. I found the ending kind of like... I read the book, and then I finished it, and then I thought later, did I actually finish it? I went through, the ending just kind of happens. It's like they pull the rug out of your feet.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, it's quite good, it's worth it, and I've never gotten tired of reading Nexus.
Yeah, I remember when I bought that along in the 80s, I guess. It was an interesting book. It was different from all the rest of the books, so...
Yeah.
I always enjoyed it, but it became, after the series ended, it kind of very sporadic. And those were done like a few years ago, and I guess they haven't really done much since, right? Nexus, or they have. And there was a while that Nexus was being drawn by other people.
Yeah, what happened was Nexus was always drawn by Steve Rude, which is what makes the book fantastic. Well, the writing's strong, but at one point, Steve Rude, I think they were supposed to have three fill-in issues. One was Mike Mignola, one was Jose Garcia Lopez.
Hmm.
There was, I can't remember who the other one was.
Paul Smith?
Not yet. I don't know if he did one at that time, but he was supposed to, I guess he went to study. But they were joking about Steve Rude was going to the South Pacific. So they had those. I think they were supposed to have three books, but they ended up having, I think, six. And then Steve Rude came back. And then after the 50th issue, I think he did one issue after that. And then they started, well, Paul Smith was doing fill-in issues here and there. And I think Keith Geffen did one, which,
yeah.
Well, I've never liked Keith Geffen, but I love that issue he drew. And, but, you know, but then after that, Paul Smith was always, he did issues here and there. And then after the 50th issue, Steve Rude did a mini-series called The Next Nexus, which is about General Loomis's daughters coming after him. It was fantastic, but they got another guy coming in to draw the regular Nexus book. And they introduced a character called Stan, which the Merc replaced, you know, Horatio Hellpop with. And then I never read those. And then Steve Rude, I don't know if he came back, and then they canceled Nexus. But then that's when Nexus went to Dark Horse, and they were doing them as miniseries.
Okay.
And I think they were always four-issue miniseries, and they were supposed to do them twice a year, maybe. And then, again, that was still in the 90s. And then finally it just kind of stopped. You know, I guess it just wasn't selling well enough. And then Steve Rude created his own company, and I think they printed three issues. But they brought it back to Dark Horse Presents, and...
You just happen to have... What's that? I've never seen that before. That's pretty humongous, man.
Steve Rude and Mike Barron are doing Nexus again as a newspaper.
This is humongous.
Oh, this thing is bigger than the Wednesday's comics that DC put out a while back.
That's beautiful.
But I didn't really understand what it was. You know, I follow Steve Rude on Facebook.
That's Steve Rude, dude.
And they keep posting about it, but it's treated like a Sunday comic back in the day. And it's one page for every comic page. I mean, it's just, it covers the whole thing. But they're four-page stories. And like I said, I never really bought it, not knowing what it was about. And I heard him, I think Steve Rude came on Word Balloon. I'm guessing that's the podcast. But you can buy them in four, I think they said four issues. Or two stories. So anyway, I bought 1 to 4. It was $15, included shipping. And then I get this in the mail. I can't remember how many they're up to now, but there's
this thing.
Yeah,
you've never seen this in a comic shop, have
no,
you?
No.
Wow.
But the printing's nice. The stock, it's on a paper stock, but it's a high end paper stock. It's really toothy. And the first story, it covers General Loomis. Nexus origin again. And then you open it up. It's got it's got filler. You know, it's more story on the inside. Then it's got filler. It's got notes, you know, production notes and, you know, pencil drawings, scripts. And then it goes into the second story. I tell you, he really channels Kirby. He channels Todd Hanna-Barbera work. And I've always said this, he channels Dr. Seuss. But then it finally gets to the back page you're talking about. It has a comic strip he did of his wife. It's got the painting of workshops that he does. Picture of him and the model and the picture he painted.
He was in Asheville, and that's where Kirby guy is. I can't believe he didn't go to that. I gotta give him a hard time about that. Matter of fact, I'm going to probably text him about it and find out what the deal is. But yeah, unbelievable.
Yeah, but that's the Nexus work is something I really like, but I don't particularly care for it unless Steve Rude is actually drawing it. But this, I'm kind of on the fence, because I was going to order the other books, and now I'm kind of, or other papers.
Did you get that at the comic shop?
No, I ordered it.
So you can't, so Diamond doesn't carry it? You don't know?
I have no idea.
Oh, wow, I've never even heard about it. That's interesting.
But it sounds like they're doing it. It's Rude Dude Productions. I ordered it, and then they sent me a message telling me it shipped, and, you know, it had package tracking. And then I was at work, and I checked it, and it was at the house. It was at the house. I read it. Then I went and worked out, and I came back at night, and I got a message from Rude Dude Productions saying, well, we see the package actually arrived at your house. I hope you're happy. Well, that was nice.
I hope you're happy.
Well, you know, I mean, they're putting it forth. Like I said, I was originally planning on buying all of them, but, you know, now...
I would. Why wouldn't you? They're nice.
Yeah, they're nice, but... The stories got me interested. Like I said, I really enjoy Nexus. When I read these, I get this thrill just like reading Carl Barks stories or, you know, Dave Cockrum stories. There's just, I love the character design. I love the storyline. I love how Steve Rude draws it. And they are massively big, but you know, like I said, it was a quick read. You know, and
yeah, it's only, what, about 5 or 6 pages or something?
Yeah, and I could have done without all the filler. I mean, I like the show notes and stuff that they did, you know, but they could have put more, you know.
How much is it? $5 or something?
15.
15?
Yeah.
That's a lot.
That's why I'm debating. That included shipping.
That's a lot.
That's why I'm kind of on the fence about buying any more.
Mm. It's beautiful, though. I wouldn't, if you could afford it, I guess, but it really seems like, I mean, $5, maybe $10, maybe.
Well, that's it. I mean, it came in a box. It's not, you know.
It came in a box? Okay.
Little flat box.
It's probably a low print run.
Yeah.
So.
But, I don't know. Like I said, I kind of want the others, but it's just, I'm not satisfied with how much I paid for it.
Mm.
And they weren't perfect. You know, there was, the end of the paper was banged, you know. Mm. it's kind of been up a little bit, which, you know,
yeah,
so which, well, I really don't care about, but,
well, hey man, you know, I've never seen it before or heard of it before, so it's, you know, it's pretty interesting. Now millions of people are going to be running out after listening to this show and ordering it, so, you know,
if you didn't get enough of Archie the last episode, Al's got something here that
that book that I got from my buddy, it's called Archie, A Celebration of America's Favorite Teenagers by Craig Yeoh. This is a great book. I totally recommend it. Like, Bob Montana was awesome, man.
You know, it's what he's doing. He's holding up it's a hardback book, and the very last page, the end papers, it's Archie sleeping in class, Miss Grundy standing with her arms crossed. He's got a daydream that he's a sultan. Betty and Veronica are both in, you know, belly dancing
Harem
gear.
Girls or something.
Yeah. Actually, Veronica's belly dancing. Betty's playing a lute. And Mr. Weatherby is a eunuch behind him, fanning him.
It looks like it was like watercolored or something.
Yeah, that's worth the price of the book just right there. That was just looked like a spot illustration he did for something. I've never seen that.
I had never did either. I mean,
and Bob Montana was great. And one thing I liked was his inking. I'm guessing he inked his own work.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, nice and loose.
Yeah, it was loose, but it had a depth to it. Like, he used thick lines, he used thin lines, but he had a field of depth to it.
Oh man, I gotta send you the link to it. There's a video on YouTube of this Archie inker, Rich Kozlowski, I think that's his name, inking a Dan DiCarlo sketch. It's amazing, man.
Wow.
I gotta send you to, because the guy's got brilliant line work, man, with that brush and doing the thick, beautiful lines and
yeah.
All that. It's amazing, but yeah, it's kind of like this. I mean, you know, it's a good thing. The thing I like about Montana, that it's slick, but it's also a little rough too. So it's got, like, you know, it's not perfectly finished or whatever.
Yeah,
you know?
It does, but he has a tightness all the
it's
same.
It's got a tightness all the same.
It looks
yeah.
like the drawings are, well, I mean, they're loose when they need to be, but it's tight, and he's given a lot of detail. It's not just, this is something that I've always brought up, I complain about. And one, it's strange to say this, but John Romita, who was fantastic and slick, but his later work, there wasn't much to it. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about stuff he drew in the 80s, you know, see? There's like a lot of surface, but there was no extras. I'm looking at this Bob Montana stuff, and he's putting all, you know, he's drawing, you know, hairs on Mr. Weatherby's chest, you know.
Yeah.
He's got, you know, little jewelry and stuff. He's adding all the little incidental things that Romita, after a while, he, like you said, it got
simplified
too slick and too kind of sterile. It's like stock. He had it down, and that's all you got.
Well, let me ask you a question. I mean, I'm not saying this is the way you feel. I'm just kind of like, there's a lot of people that, and I'm saying you, I'm saying just in general, that they look at somebody's work, and if it's simple, they think that, oh, well, this is nice, but I like this other guy here that puts in a lot of details, because he's like, you know, it's got like, look, every, you know, brick has got, like, a whatever. I mean, is that, like, important, or is that just, like, something that you notice because you notice that his work had that before, and now he seems like he's, like, glossing over, you know, a lot
I,
of
I know what you mean. I like simple work. When Mobius,
but you like details.
I do like details.
Okay.
Well, like, here's an example. Mobius, you know, his early work was very heavily detailed.
Yeah.
Jaime Hernandez was another one. His older work, even though he had a simple way of drawing, he had a lot of detail. Both those artists, as they went on, started stripping everything down. Alex Toth was another one. I love what they did. A lot of people complain, especially about Mobius and Jaime Hernandez. But even though it was stripped down, they still had a lot of, you know, folds and clothes, you know, little incidental things like clay pots.
They weren't glossing over things.
Exactly. There's a difference between that and an artist
being lazy.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they just give you what they have to and then go on. And a lot of artists that continued to work and didn't stop, I want to say that they had the drawing ability, but basically you've seen it millions of times. As simple as Mobius got, I never saw what he was doing millions of times. He never got to a lazy trope of just constantly doing. When I say that, if I was ever able to do that kind of work, I would have been possibly in the same thing where, you know, you're still doing the same licks, you're still doing the same compositions, you have a few stock compositions you always use.
Well, let me ask you a question about that. What about as much as we love and think Jack Kirby's the greatest, how many times, and we'll give you an example, did you see cover one of the monster books?
Oh, yeah. No, Jack Kirby, and especially his the later work he's doing in the 80s, he fell into that, too.
He was doing it in the 50s, too.
Yeah.
He had the Jack Kirby point at the monster while he's, like, talking to the audience, or like, the Gil Kane death pose in the 70s. Every character was, like, lying.
Yes.
Dead, you know,
or twisted.
Ground.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's what you're absolutely right. That's,
I mean, that can be considered a stylistic thing or considered a laziness, depending on your point of view.
Yeah, there's certain things, and some of them didn't bother me so much. And
yeah.
People always reference the fact Jack Kirby would have a character jumping straight at you with his legs spread out, which never would have worked. But it looked awesome.
It looked
when he did.
Kirby did it.
One thing I want to say, I read this somewhere. And I wanted to read it. It says, Kirby knew the medium. And many still think to this day that Kirby could not draw. He just knew the medium of comic books and knew what worked, the dramatic. That's well said. It was on Facebook. Somebody posted, it had been published in Amazing Heroes that I saw back in the 80s, but I'm sure it's been published in a lot of places. It was a drawing of his wife, Roz. And he drew it in the foxhole when he was in Europe in World War II. Fantastic. It was a fantastic portrait. And it didn't look, I mean, you could tell it was Jack Kirby, but it didn't have
it was
that.
It a memory drawing,
yeah.
Too.
And, but I mean, it looked like a nice portrait somebody would buy of a woman in the 40s. And that's when somebody published it and they're talking about it. And one of the people commented on it and they said that, yeah, that's absolutely it. He could draw, but, you know, he had a shorthand. But I'll tell you, when you read that stuff, it was like, a thumbnail to greatness. You know, it just gave you imagination. To this day, people are still working on what Jack Kirby was putting out. You know, he fueled imagination. He brought us to other worlds, other dimensions. The scope of his work is second to none. And even though he did have a bluntness to the work later on, it's just nobody like him.
I think a lot of people, not us, but a lot of people, you remember Kirby more fondly because he's gone, because I remember a lot of Kirby bashing in the 80s and stuff like that. So there's all that too. But again, we've talked about this many times about at what point do you just appreciate the artist because of the fact that they're still drawing, or do you gauge them by, like, do you have to, you know, I mean, like you said, Toth, the more he simplified, a lot of ways, the better his work got, because it was like it became a different thing. But he was like a different kind of artist, you know. And he wasn't, I don't consider Toth a comic book artist. I consider him like a designer, and he could do anything.
Yeah.
You know, whereas some guys to me are like great comic book artists. So he's like in a different level in a lot of ways, like Kirby and people like that. But I mean, at some point, I don't know if the right word is, just have to give him slack. It's like, okay, he's still around, he's still drawing. It might not be, like, as good as his 60s work, but you still got him, man. And he's still there, you know, and he's still doing it for you. And he's probably better than like three quarters of the guys that are working in comics now. So.
Like I said, as time went on, he started getting more and more blunt. Even the DC work, it started out something, but then it's the same thing. You started seeing a lot of the things he'd already done, but he still had that open imagination that nobody else seemed to have.
Because Rude he's still trying. He could simplify his work a lot, but he's still trying to do even though his work doesn't look much different than it did 20 years ago, he's still trying, and he's probably like in his 50s now, so he's still putting out strong work.
Oh yeah.
But even Frazetta kind of like towards the end, I don't know if he went downhill, but he had the strokes, so he had to draw with his left hand.
Well, see, I thought he did go downhill, but when you told me that he started learning how to draw with the left hand,
that's beyond amazing.
Well, yeah, that's what happened. But the thing was, when I saw his, after a while, it just looked like he's kind of doing the same stock things over and over. Once I say that, Robert Crumb in Comics Journal, he drew one of Frazetta's paintings. They had a sketch in the interview, and he was talking about it because I guess Gary Groff was surprised, and he said, "Well, I was just looking at it to see," and he says, "It's all there." He says, "The man understands composition. You know, his composition is on the spot. His color, theory is right there. His technique is there." He says, "It's all there," and Robert Crumb was working on it to learn, but then he just said. One thing, though, is once you have them down, you realize what a piece of cake it was. Well, he had it down. It was always the same thing. You know, Gil Kane talked about Frazetta at one point about just how good he was. He says, you know, the problem is it's always the same thing. You know, it's these big buxom women with China doll faces.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and what you're saying that, I kind of thought that of Gil Kane's work. And I love Gil Kane. But, you know, you could always see it was a Gil Kane. He always had those up shots for the face. You know, he always had the twisted bodies. And,
if you look at Frazetta's work, and, you know, it might be the same composition or similar composition, the same, woman over and over again.
Yeah.
But there's so much subtlety there if you look at the backgrounds, if you look at what he leaves in and he takes out, if you look at the way he just kind of like, suggests things and you believe it. You know what I mean? Like two or three lines can suggest like a graveyard and you believe it. There's a lot more going on there than just like, you know. The problem with Frazetta is that, I mean, at the point when he was doing assignments for people, they wanted a Conan or they wanted a Barbarian or they wanted something. So basically after a while, he's like, well, you know, if that's what you want, here's what I'm going to give you. You know?
Oh, and he did it. I loved it. I loved all of it. He was second to none. He was.
Yeah.
He became something unto himself. I mean, he's the name Frazetta strikes
it's a big
up
deal.
One thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
People have tried, but nobody's come close to it. You know. But everybody always have pencil drawings of stuff he did, like in the late 90s and. I was just like, well, I've seen this before. He just had a stock pose.
I say the same thing for people like Alex Ross.
Yeah.
And people like that. But you can't really, you can say it, but you can't really say it because it's like, it looks the same to you just because maybe there's so much of it. Maybe if there was less of it, you'd be more like, oh, wow, look at that. That's pretty cool or whatever. But the amount of work that takes to get there, I don't know. It's pretty amazing.
You are correct. And that's the other thing was, sometimes there's an artist that everybody likes.
Yeah.
And then after a while, people say, well, I've seen enough of it. I mean, some people, they just can't get enough, no matter what. I'm that way. There's a lot of artists you and I both like. But then one of us, I can't think of any of them right now, but some of them I continue to read. I just don't ever put them down where it's just, yeah, I've seen that, it's good. But, you know, you've seen enough. And vice versa. There's artists that we both love, but you've continued on looking at them.
Always.
And I've never stopped liking them, but I'm thinking, well, I've seen this work before and enough. I mean, it happens.
Because I think for me, it's more so than like trying to get a new story or an interesting storyline. I think it's more comforting. You know what I mean? It's like they're still drawing good. It still looks good. It might be repetitive, but it's comforting to see something that, you know, I enjoy, and it's still there, and it's still trying in some way or another to entertain me. No matter how, you know, similar it might be than something else. I mean, you and I are in agreement on a lot of things, But you're more story oriented than I am.
Yeah, I do like story oriented than I am.
I mean, I don't want a crappy story, but if you're repeating the same story, but you know, it's people that I like doing it, I'll go along with it. I only have to pay $100 for it. You know, it's reasonable. Yeah. That's the other thing. Well, you have to pay to get it. You know, if it's cheap, you go, okay, yeah, but if you got to pay $5, $10, $20, is it really worth the, you know, the money you're forking in to, you know, do it? So there's a lot of factors going into it.
You know, what you just talked about, I was going to bring up, I've got a bunch of Dollar Box comments I want to go over.
Okay.
And that's something I was going to say on this.
Those are all worth $1 or more.
They were, but
I mean, would you pay more than $1 for something?
Well, that's what I'm going to say. All this stuff I'm getting ready to go through here, I found these in Dollar Boxes. I read them. I really enjoyed them. And it's a diverse thing, and I'm thinking, man, this is great. What a wonderful world. But I wouldn't have enjoyed them if I would have paid more than $1 for them. You know what I mean? I mean,
okay.
Some of them possibly. And I mean, there are a lot of books I buy.
Hey, we're going to do a couple of music breaks. Can we take a break now?
Yes,
we'll come back and talk about them.
Sure.
Foolish winter, to think that the snow will freeze my heartaches. Foolish spring, think that your blossom can cheer my soul. Foolish summer, to think that the sun will dry my tears. And foolish autumn, to think that I won't love you for years and years. With flowers I will forget. Foolish summer, to think that your blue skies matter at all. And foolish autumn, to think that all will be well.
You can hear our most recent 20 episodes on iTunes. If you would like to hear our older episodes, you can find them on our blog. Just go to bunchofdorks.com and click on the Cyclops.
And we're back. And that was an interesting person. Her name is Dana Gillespie. I knew her as an actress in some Hammer movies. She's very beautiful. Very buxom, as they say. She was also in one of those Edgar Rice Burroughs movies with Peter Cushing and Doug McClure.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if it was The People, The Time Forgot, or, you know, she was one of those. We'll have the poster on the. So she recorded in the 60s, which I knew she did some recordings, but I didn't know that. So I found this one album online called, and the title song is called Foolish Season. Basically, I know she was connected with Bowie, because she was like a buddy of his, and there's actually, like, on YouTube, she's doing a cover. There's a cover off the BBC of her doing the song Andy Warhol, Bowie and Ronson playing on it, and her singing it, and it's really good. But this song, Foolish Season, from like 68 or 67, apparently, like, Donovan, she was buddies with Donovan too, so he got her the gig, and it's like, I think Jimmy Page actually plays on this song and more songs off their circuit, so it's pretty interesting. It's a nice ballad tune. She has a really nice voice. So, yeah, I just found that the other day, and I was like, oh, that's cool. I was thinking, that's something we could play on Two Dimension because it's nobody that I played before. It's somebody, you know, off blue
neat.
Or whatever. She still sings. She does blues, but she's got a really nice voice, and you'll see her picture. She's memorable. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, well, she was a Hammer girl.
She was in the Lost Continent, I think. That's the one she was in for Hammer, and then the other ones were for Amicus, the Edgar Rice Burroughs, and she did other movies too. She's an attractive.
I love that movie, Lost Continent.
You remember that? You saw that?
Well, you told
she's
me.
She's the girl. She kind of looks a little peasanty or whatever, but you know, she's got her. She's got like that kind of like buckskin jacket or something like that.
Yeah, because we kept talking about that. I remember that's the one with the crustaceans, the Spanish guy.
Yes, because
I saw that with Beneath the Planet of the Apes and some other movie.
Really?
We talked about this on the show.
I forgot.
In 1973
or two?
It was either end of 1970 or beginning of 1971. The kids next door to me, they went to the movies all the time. The mother would take them to one and drop them off. And I got to go. And it was Beneath the Planet of the Apes and then The Lost Continent, which I didn't know. And they didn't stop the movies. It was just one would start and the other would start.
Really? No.
And it was all kids. And it was in the evening. It was Sunday evening. And I remember I went there and we walked in. They were showing Lost Continent. And then they showed, what was it? They showed we walked in. They were showing the end of Beneath the Planet of the Apes. And then they showed The Lost Continent. And then they showed this movie. I guess it was in, Sri Lanka. It was these kids that got a baby elephant. And I saw it in school one time. And then they showed The Planet of the Apes again.
Well, that would really suck if you showed up at the end of Beneath the Planet of the Apes, because that would ruin the movie for you, wouldn't it?
No, it didn't matter to me.
Okay.
You know, nobody cared.
There's a big, you know, whatever at the end of that movie.
You know, but I remember The Lost Continent, well, even the Beneath the Planet of the Apes, when they showed those mutants, it was a lot of crustaceous-looking special effects that were freaking us out. You know, I was nine.
You know, I don't have the images, and I don't even know if they exist, but I read an article one time saying that the original makeup for the mutants was even more hideous than what they showed.
Well,
they wanted it to be even worse, but they ended up settling on what they did.
Well, at 9 years old, that was enough. But
yeah.
I'd always tell people about Lost Continent, and when I got to know you, I was asking you, and you didn't remember. And then one day I came in, and a friend of yours sent it to you. And they showed it on USA, and you had a DVD you burned for me. And I watched it again, and yeah, it was all there. When I was telling you, I didn't remember all the things like that. They were transporting, the captain was transporting that illegal fuel. And I forgot about, I remembered the balloon. I remember they burned everything up.
The balloons, yeah.
And, but there were certain things that I'd kind of forgotten. As soon as I saw it, it all came back, and I just misremembered it with other stuff. But yeah, what a neat movie. And you left all the commercials in. I saw these commercials for CompuServe and AOL. And
that's great.
Yeah, I didn't realize how much the world changed since the mid-90s, you know.
You know what we watched for Slow Robot this week was What's Up Tiger Lily.
Really?
Yeah, I found it on YouTube, so we watched it. Martin liked it, but neither one of us thinks it's a hilarious. I didn't think it was the most hilarious thing. I thought there were some laughs in it, but we watched it, and I was thinking about you because of Key of Keys, which is the supposedly they put out a DVD, which I don't have, of What's Up Tiger Lily, and that DVD gives you the option of watching the movie International Spy Key of Keys with the original dubbing without comedy on it, supposedly. Oh. Now, to me it seems like if they're going to show you that movie, it's going to be a completely different movie because Woody Allen edited the hell out of it, it seems like, to make What's Up Tiger Lily, but I don't know.
Well, it wasn't one movie. He took three of them. It was a series.
I think the beginning of it, have you seen What's Up Tiger Lily?
I watched part of it on television once.
The beginning of it is in Japanese, the first 5 minutes, and that seems like it's from another movie. The rest of it, maybe, but it seems to be it's the same people, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So maybe there's one part, the beginning is one movie, maybe the beginning when he meets this one girl is another movie, but then the rest of it seems like it's the same movie, but I don't know. I don't never seen I've never seen the uncut version.
I was watching it, fascinating, because it's like the Hammer movies. I love those colors from the 60s.
Oh, yeah.
They were vibrant, but they were kind of flat, but they were bright. And
I got to give you the time travel. I got the file in there, because it's what you're talking about. It's a time travel movie, but it's got beautiful colors.
I love that. I love that, and I like the style. Of course, that's when we grew up, so I love that time.
Yeah.
But I was watching it, and I don't know, it was really sophomoric. And I remember at one point, Myrna kind of giggled, and then later she goes, "Do we have to watch this?" "No." And I was asking Al, and I asked another guy I know, if they could get me copies of that International Key. And I got them, but the quality is so bad. It doesn't look like What's Up Tiger Lily. But I'd be interested, because I would like to see the movie as it originally was, but
It's an interesting movie. Yeah. I mean, from what I saw, beautiful women, and but it looks like the original might have been a little bit of a tongue in cheek.
Well, there was another movie Woody Allen did. It was a black and white one. I've never seen it. People talk about it. Where it's old historical footage, and
Zelig.
Yeah, and he walks through it.
Yeah,
and
Zelig.
And people are saying, I really don't know how he did it. And now it's not an issue. You can just do it through all the computer applications, but at the time he did it, it was shocking. But I don't know, some of those, to me, it was kind of a gimmicky thing that he played with, and it was amazing then, but now maybe not so much.
Well, that's the thing with Tiger Lily. It's like you watch it and you go, wow, this is like the first time anybody did this on film, because I think they did it on television. I think they would mock movies in the 60s on television and some shows. That's the first time on film. That's interesting, but it's a nice try. And it does have some laughs in it, but it's not as funny as Bananas or Take the Money and Run or Sleeper or whatever. But it is a good idea. And Mao was comparing it, because he had that show Dub 420, and they were doing similar things, but his show was more like vulgar and angry than this was or whatever. But in this movie, you can see that the actors were actually trying to match the mouth lip movements of the people, so they actually were trying to make it seem like, okay, here's the story, but, off the wall or whatever. So, yeah, we did watch that. But I can see where it's not, like, hilarious. But it does have its moments. Cool. It does have a couple of good lines in it. So, anyway, we got away from the comic books, but
we're back. Don't worry, Dallas, we're back.
Before
we start talking about the dollar books, I do want to bring something up. Shade the Changing Girl, 04. Now, I've talked about this before. It's a book that I'm reading pretty religiously now, but I have to admit, this has quickly turned into my favorite book, and I wasn't even going to get it. I like the art style. That's what pulled me in, but the story is getting me. But it's amazing, because it's an avian-type alien, but the world she came from, it's not the same kind of people. They're all different creatures. And she gets I guess it's a cloak from Shade the Changing Man, the one, I don't know who wrote it, Pete Milligan? But,
yeah, maybe.
Anyway,
well, the original was Ditko.
Yeah, Ditko created the original. I just looked it up. But I was wondering why she was going through all this, because she took over a body of a girl that was in intensive care that was dying. Well, the girl, she's in high school, and she was a living monster to all these other people. All these friends of hers are scared to death of her. And she came back. She has no clue. Apparently, she's got adoptive parents that are scared of her. And she's trying to deal with this. And that kind of fascinates me. And I was wondering, why is she going through this if it's so alien? Why doesn't she go back? And also the other thing is, she's got the memories, some of the memories. She has no idea what's going on, but she gets some feelings and memories from the girl. She also, all the hormones and everything going on that she doesn't understand. And I'm thinking, why doesn't she just go back? Well, she can't find her body to go back. But her friend in that other place has her body hidden, so the law doesn't come after her, because she stole the cloak out of a museum. But it keeps switching back to the other place she came from. I bought this yesterday, and I was jumping. I'm not subscribing to this. I found it on the wall.
Oh, I thought you subscribed.
No, I love the young animal books, but I haven't subscribed to any of them.
Oh, and, you did.
Well, if I was a smarter,
you will now.
I was a smarter man, I would have, but
well, how would you know?
I bought them off the racks, and yesterday when I saw this, I was jumping up and down. I went home, and this was the first thing I read. And I thought, man, this is... I like Doom Patrol a lot. You know, the new Doom Patrol, which I lent to you. I like Cave Carson. I'm loving this one. I'm really shocked. I wasn't even going to get it. But I picked up the first issue. Well, I like the art. This looks interesting, but the story is right there. This is fantastic. So I'm paying $3.99 for it, and I don't mind.
Okay.
Anyway, going to the dollar box pile, we'll just go through each one I got.
Now, you're saying that these, you're glad you got them for a buck because you wouldn't want to pay more than that.
Yeah.
You are paying more than that on a regular basis for Black Widow, though.
Well, the Black Widow I'm reading is the Chris Samney.
That's not Chris Samney?
This is Phil Noto.
He's good.
He is good.
He's good. He's local.
I worked, really?
I was one time at a comic shop, and they mentioned him, that he was a local guy.
Because a friend of mine, she loved Phil Noto. She always picked up books and stuff, and she always
painted,
talked about
right,
him.
Painted, right, or no?
No.
Oh, he does paint beautiful painted work.
Yeah, right? And I've seen that, and it's equally as beautiful.
Yeah, that's nice. Maybe too beautiful.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure who. I've never heard the writer, Edmondson. Nathan Edmondson.
Mm.
But the work I'm reading on Black Widow is the Chris Samney book, and that is fantastic. This one goes right along with it. It's a $3.99 cover price. But basically, you know, it has her trapped. All these agents are beating her, and then she tears them to pieces. She's working with S.H.I.E.L.D. I enjoyed it. I mean, if it was a dollar, I would have bought the whole series. Yeah. I liked it, but I'm not going to go back to find all the other issues for $4. This is one Al pushed on me, or not, he showed it to me. Didn't push
strong
it.
Arm, I think.
Yeah. No, you just pointed out, and I jumped on it. It was Batlash, Hooves of Fury. This is issue 5 of 6. Walt Simonson did the cover, and the inside...
John Severin.
Yeah, John Severin. Nicely drawn, nicely covered. He's an artist that never lost it for me. You know, I just always enjoyed it. He always had good strong drawings, compositions. And when I say that, I always found his compositions a little pedestrian, but it didn't matter. It went right with what he did. And his inking, it never lost it. He never got comfortable. I mean, maybe he was comfortable with it, but it just never seemed lazy to me. But this is written by Peter Brandevold. I think he's saying his name is Sergio Arganez. And John Severin drew it. The story was good, too. He's trying to save this woman. He's living with the Indians. These are worth finding for full price. So even though
Did Severin do all of them?
I don't know.
So you would pay full price for that?
Yeah, I would. Yeah. I would pay full price for this, but I got it for a dollar, thanks, Al.
Okay.
And, you know, John Severin did,
Yeah.
Right?
Itching out.
Oh.
Anyway.
John Severin did, in the 80s. It was like 85. It was, what's Marvel's cowboy?
Rawhide Kid.
Yeah, Rawhide Kid. I remember John Byrne drew the cover, and the interior was done by Herb Trimpe and inked by John Severin.
Mm-hmm.
And that was shocking, because I do not like Herb Trimpe.
Oh, yeah. It wasn't the gay Rawhide Kid. It was the one that... It was in the 80s, and I think a Filipino artist did one issue, too. Yeah, I have those.
Well, John Severin only inked the first issue. I remember I bought it, and I was thrilled by it, and then that store, I was in the Navy, but when I went home, and the guy at the store said, have you read that? He was reading it. He was like an 8-year-old boy reading it. He goes, have you seen this? Yeah, I got it in San Diego. And he was so happy. And then I was so disappointed when the next issue came out and it wasn't inked by John Severin. It lost everything, you know.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
All right. The next one is Legendary Star-Lord, number 12. Is Dallas knows, and Al knows, that I always yell that's not Star-Lord because Star-Lord is the one that John Byrne and Terry Austin drew. But this, I guess, is a Star-Lord from the movies. But I like the artwork. I'm not familiar with the art team or the writer.
Oh.
I don't think. Who's the creative team? If you read
Sam Humphries is the writer. Oh, God, the artists are Paco Medina, a lot of Spanish people. Juan Velasco and Andrea Sorrentino.
I'm glad you read that, because it would have sounded horrifying if I read it. now the writer, I've Sam Humphries, I can't think of what it is, but I have read his stories before. I have to admit that even though this is completely alien from the Star-Lord work that I read back in the 70s, it held my attention. And I can't tell if that's actually Peter Quill or another guy. But I enjoyed it. And it was fun. It was like kind of like reading an X-Men story back in the 80s or 70s. But I guess the Star-Lord's daughter finds him frozen. And there's some wheeler dealer that's got it, and he's threatening her, and she's trying to take the...
What year is this? This is like a couple years ago?
I don't know. It must be kind of recent.
I'm trying to find the...
Indicia?
Yeah, 2015.
Yeah, just a couple years ago.
A year and a half ago. What's interesting to me is there's a convention in here. It's like a Washington convention, and Shatner and Sulu are going to be there. I thought they hated each other's guts, but I guess for bucks they'll do it, you know?
Yeah, money changes everything.
Yeah, anyway. Nice book. I mean, the art is a style which I see a lot these days. To me, that's a style that, like, I see, and as well done as it is, and it's beautiful. It just looks like a lot of artists that, like, it looks, I wouldn't say it looks exactly like Imagey, but maybe, you know, a little bit.
No, everything you're saying is exactly what I see.
But it's beautiful, though, so I can't really criticize it. I'm just saying.
It's great work, but it's just not of a taste that appeals to us. I agree.
Exactly.
I read it. I mean, if somebody I knew read these books, I would want
to
read them.
It appeals to me. But it doesn't, like, call me, you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when I say it, it's great, it's good, but I really don't want to own it.
How's that for a left-handed compliment?
It is good work. It's just, you can't like everything.
No, you can try, but no. Except old artists. I like all of them, pretty much.
I like a lot of them, but I don't like every one of them.
I think I do now.
That's what makes you unique, though, because you have an appreciation for a lot of those things. And I have a feeling another 10, 20 years, you're going to start looking at that.
Yeah,
like,
maybe.
Know.
There's maybe a couple of artists that I don't like from back in the olden days. Maybe more. I mean, talking about professionally, though, anyway.
I wonder if I would have met you in the 70s if I would have found you a really bitter teenager.
No, but I'm always picky. I'm less picky now with, what was then. I'm more picky now with what's current. So, probably I would have been a lot pickier with my artist back then than I am now.
It's a different understanding.
Age definitely, makes things look a little better.
Well, yeah, time teaches.
If it ages well. All movies age well, but, you know.
And as you go through a lot of life experiences, your outlook changes.
Well, not to mention that you and I both draw, so we're seeing this through different eyes. We don't see it. We don't just see this as storytelling. We see the problem solving, how you draw, what style you use, how the hell do you ink that? Are you using a brush? Are you using a pen? Why does this look like Scott Williams? Why do you make it look like, some other inker or whatever? It's a lot of... Anyway. Okay. Doctor Strange.
Yeah, and this one, when I grabbed it, I was happy to get this, but I thought Craig Russell drew this. Mm-hmm. I've never bought them, but I saw some Doctor Strange by Craig Russell, and that's the same logo. And I would have bought them, but I never saw them except online. But that was Doctor Strange, The Oath. I can't think of what issue it is, but I guess it's so many issues. And what's funny is it starts out with Doctor Strange and Wong, his partner, and a woman who turns out to be Night Nurse.
Oh, yeah?
From the 70s. But she doesn't look... The Night Nurse, I remember, I thought she had red hair. And this one's got black hair, but she has a hospice. And
now, I must say, this art I like better.
Yeah, I really like this artwork, even though it... At first, when I saw the cover, I thought of Craig Russell. But again, part of that was the logo.
It's 2007, too. This is a while ago.
Yeah, it's funny. I always say this. I still see the year 2000 as the future. So when I hear 2007, it doesn't seem that long ago to me. But I liked it. I was a little disappointed that I finished it and I never saw any other issues. But it's worth picking up.
Well, I'm trying to credit people, but here you go. Brian K. Vaughan and Marcos Martin. Really good. I think this style is a little, I mean, sometimes that style, like
Star-Lord,
is a little, I don't know, it's a little too pretty or pristine. Yeah. I like it a little grittier, maybe. I don't know. But I like this, I like the inking work on this better.
Well, this one has a, when I say this, it's not, but.
Maybe it's the inking that I like better.
Sometimes it has an impish look to it. Mike Waringo. It looks like a lot of Mike Waringo's work, which I liked.
Yeah.
But it has that kind of perfect plasticky look.
That perfect Croquel, perfect look to it.
It's I mean, it's strong, and they have an imagination. There are alien landscapes and all the hardware and stuff.
Oh, hell yeah.
It's there. But you like more rough and ready.
Yeah, man.
But yeah, this one, I really like the Doctor Strange, the Oath. If I found any others, I'd probably pick them up if they were in
the dollar. Did you get all these at Yancey?
Wilson's.
No, oh, you got these at Wilson's. Oh, okay, they got these at Yancey. That's a lot of them. You got these at Wilson's last week?
No.
This is throughout.
Sometimes I go through, if I don't have anything in my box, I go through the dollar boxes, and I sometimes pull out a stack. And I've talked about some of them, but this is. I was wanting to talk about these last week, but again, we were driving, so I didn't bother.
Well, because, I mean, most of these books are, like, impressive in certain ways, you know what I mean? So, yeah.
Well, it's what I said.
They're all worth a couple bucks to me, anyway.
When you and I went to Nerd Out Comics last time, that's one thing I was talking about. We were going through the dollar box, which is a blast. But you're searching for things you want to get. But all I think when I'm looking through these is that all the effort the people put in. I mean, when they created the work, when they were, you know, drawing, when they were writing the stories, inking it, when the production people for the publishing company put them together, the distribution, the marketing, I mean, all the effort was there. None of the stuff is garbage. It just may not be something that I want.
None of it is garbage.
It was thrown in at a dollar box. But
you got to be a badass to work for these guys. You can't be him.
So when I'm saying that, to me, it's just a treasure trove, and it's also a way to take a chance on something. And, you know, I see a lot of the books that I paid full price in the dollar box. And I always try to get Al to buy them, and either he did buy them or he doesn't want them. But, like, a lot of the Mike Allred FF books that they had, I find those in there. Some of the Chris Samnee Captain America and, you know, other books that he drew. Again, a lot of the books that I bought, I never get upset. I'm not like, oh, I could have got this for a dollar. I was happy to get them when I got them. I try to get my friends to buy them, and they don't. But it's a way you could find stuff that you might enjoy that you didn't know was out, or it's a gateway to something you may immediately find.
It's a gateway drug.
Now, here's something. I've talked about this before. I found another issue of this in a dollar box I talked about before. But it's the Unbeatable Squirrel Girl. This is issue 12. Now, this isn't a book I buy. I see it on the racks. And, I mean, I remember Rook mentioned it. He laughed. He knew who Squirrel Girl was. I bought an earlier issue, and I really enjoyed it. Issue 12, this was fun, because she starts out, and I guess she's arguing with somebody in traffic. There's a bank robbery. And then her friend convinces her to take a vacation. So she goes to see her mother. They don't say where it is. Ends up it's in Canada. And the mother's living in a cabin out in the middle of nowhere with no internet, no electricity. And they have magazines, but they're all, you know, homemaking and outdoor magazines, which to some people's heaven, to some people that's just the last thing you want to read, you know. But it's really neat. They got a character that's basically a giant robot body with a glass dome, with a skull, I mean with a brain and two eyes floating in it. And they're wearing a mask like Robin does, and they're crime fighting, but they don't understand they can't distinguish from one human to another. They all look the same. It's a fun book. And then as it goes on, there's a problem happening in the house, and Squirrel Girl just lifts the entire cabin up, and there's this whole city of little tiny people underneath. These little tiny people can join together and make one huge person. The way the artist drew it, it was great fun. And I was sorry that the book ended. I'm like, you know. Again, this isn't a book that I want to pay $3.99 for, if that is the price.
Probably.
But when I say that, it's worth $3.99. I enjoyed it, but I just don't really want it, but I bought two of these issues out of the dollar box. The Unbeatable Squirrel Girl is a really good
book.
This
is pretty new. I'm surprised it was in the box. This is November 2016.
Well, what happens? I was surprised.
After 3 months, they probably dump them in there.
Well, because one time I was there with Dez, and they had I think it was an Avengers book. I like the cover design. It was a real cartoony drawing, but it's kind of close to this. And it just interested me. But the first issue was in the box. The second issue was on the stands. So I bought it, but it was a Wednesday, so the comic book guy was there. And I told him, look, I saw the second issue on the wall, but this one was in the box. Yeah, I threw it in there. It's just not selling, so I just tossed it. So, you know, it's what you said. He's just looking at this. It's not moving. Just get rid of it.
Just no, so, you know what? That's better than what others do. They just bag it because it's dead stock after it's
right
there.
But, you know, they do leave some books up on the wall, and that's fine. This one here, I've never heard of.
I have some of those. These are beautiful, man.
That's an understatement. Now, I got two issues. It's Velvet, The Secret Lives of Dead Men. And I'll tell you, I got 10 and 11 out of the dollar box. And this is by Ed Brubaker, Steve Epting, and Brett Weiser. I'll tell you, this is...
It looks almost, in a lot of ways, it almost looks like Al Williamson or something.
Okay. Elizabeth Brettweiser is the colorist. And these are just... Steve Epting, I know of. I've seen some of his work. This guy can do anything. I am going to be saying this. Artists that try to draw in a really realistic style, a lot of times leave me cold.
It looks like a photograph.
Yeah, well, it looks like a photograph, and there's sometimes they just can't pull it off. It's like they're good at copying certain things and then not being able to fill in the void on things they can't see. And sometimes you have a consistency, a problem of keeping everything consistent all the time. This guy, I felt like I was in the world. I felt like I was watching a movie. And this character is both beautiful and like a real person, and kind of, sometimes you can see a haggardness to her.
She looks rough.
Yeah. And
she's not young, neat looking either.
And although I do question why, ever since Steranko, all female spies have black hair with a white streak in it. Yeah. Nevertheless, I can't get enough of it.
I have like a first two or three issues of this.
Do you
then
really?
I lost track of them. Yeah, I can find them.
Do you like it?
I liked it. Yeah.
Well, here, why don't you take these? I bought them. I can't say enough. This is a fantastic series. I read these two issues, and there's certain things. One, the artwork sucked me right in there. Ed Brubaker can write a story. And this one, she's fighting people on a train. Then this one guy's got her. Everybody in this thing is smoking, and they know how to smoke, you know, to control time. And then come to find out, you're not really sure who to trust and who not to trust. And like I said, I just read two issues. This thing has got me hooked. I think I emailed Dallas, and he was asking what I was reading. I told him
this. Trades of those.
I think he did, but I'll tell you, I cannot say enough about that series.
This is what, 10 or 11?
Yeah.
Okay. I think I may have like one or two.
And when I say this, I got them out of a dollar box, and I did say that, you know, a lot of these books that I wanted to buy, those are worth buying. If they were $8 an issue, that is worth buying. And if you can get them in trades, just do it. You know, it's fantastic. All right, the next one is...
This I've never heard of. I know, I like Mark Wheatley, but I've never heard of this.
Read the title.
Frankenstein Mobster. Yep.
Mark Wheatley is somebody that I like and don't like all at the same time. The first thing I can probably recall... He was a partner with Mark Hempel and did that first issue comics, Mars, which I liked. And one thing I found strange on Mars was it said that they both, it's not like one pencils and one inks, they both do all the drawing, you know, penciling and inking simultaneously. And I never quite understood how that mix worked, but they had similar styles and they were friends. They were kind of partners.
Mm.
But I tended to like Mark Hempel's.
I do too, in a way. He's more tighter.
Yeah, he's tighter, and he has a style. Sometimes Mark Wheatley, when I say this, I can never come close to the things he does. But sometimes I find a laziness to some of the things he does, like a shorthand. After Mars finished, he did four issues of a Dracula series for Warp Graphics or Apple Comics or something in the 80s. And I bought them, but I'm looking at them thinking, you know, you could have developed this a little more, done this. And when I say that, I hate to criticize him because I can't come close to what he does. He's a good writer. He wrote that Hammer of the Gods series that Michael Omien drew. He's involved. I follow him on Facebook. He's always drawing. He's great, but sometimes I find that shorthand that I don't particularly care for. But I remember Frankenstein Monster came out from Image. I never read them. I just wasn't interested. But I found this at the Dollar Box. I like how he plays. You know, the cover is a painting, but it's not like he models the paints and he's making sure you understand it's he's got a depth to it. It's a graphic look that I really like, and I'm not a painting type person for most part. He's got a pulp look to it. I like how the lettering is, the colors, and on the inside he's got a rough graphic style. So everything I said before I take back, and it starts on the inside cover. He's playing around with this thing like nobody else, but this is issue 6, and I have no idea what's quite going on, but there's a Frankenstein mobster. Is basically, it looks like a Solomon Grundy kind of dead mobster that came back.
Mm-hmm.
Ends up being the father of this lady cop that's out trying to find him. There's also another mobster that's basically a tiger in a suit. They have a girl they're trying to find, and her mother's a witch. It's got everything in this thing. The monsters out of the bog coming out are just fantastic. I found another one of these at Wilson's in a Dollar Box, and I snagged it too. Mark Wheatley can write, and he can draw, and it was a fun series.
Dr. Cyborg.
Yeah, it's another Mike Olney. Yeah, it's Frankenstein Monster is a fun book. If you find it traded at the Dollar Box or anything, get it.
Would you pay more than $1 for it?
This is $2.95. Probably not.
Okay.
Check it out. I mean, like I said, I probably wouldn't, but one big reason is there's so many...
Hey, you're not made of money, right?
Exactly. There's so many comic books I am enjoying.
Yeah.
If it was one of those cases where it just wasn't many comic books that I did like coming out, I would go for it. So it's one of those things I'm on the fence. It's,
yeah, that's the thing you always have to take into consideration when we talk about whether you buy or not. How much, you know, do you really have? Do you have a mortgage? Do you have a family? Do you have bills? Do you have this? Do you have that? Are you rich? Are you poor? Or whatever.
Now, that is one thing I want to say on all these books here. I'm saying I probably wouldn't have bought them if they weren't a dollar. But that's me and my taste. But it's not saying that they're not worth a dollar. It's just that, you know...
Personal.
Yeah, it's personal. But if you bought it for more than a dollar, well, it is worth it. All right, Scarlet Witch 9. I found this in a dollar books box. Scarlet Witch is a book that I've been reading. I do pay full price for it. But this is the issue that I never got. And anyway, I found the dollar box, score. And the reason I put it in here... One I talk about a lot, but this one was really unique because Quicksilver, her brother, shows up. And it's always a different artist every issue, but it's Robinson. James Robinson writes it.
Mm.
And he's able to take all the past continuity and all the things that the character's gone through, which by this time it's been, 50 years? It's been a lot of crap. And somehow he's able to weave it all together where it makes sense, and he doesn't like dismiss some things and make new things up. But it's basically talking about the relationship and what's happening, and he goes with Quicksilver's personality, Wanda's personality. And even though I haven't read all those series, I read them back in the 70s when I was a kid, and I've read things in the 80s, and I've heard about other things, and fantastic. And I do pay full price for that.
Mm.
This last one is a book I never heard of. It's called Jonesy. It's from Boom.
Mm.
But
Sam Humphries. He wrote one of these other books.
Oh, okay, yeah, that's what we're just talking. I know I've read his stories before.
He's one of those. It's Sam Humphries.
But this one, it's drawn in a manga style, but it's got two girls in the cover. One girl, instead of eyeballs, she has hearts. But they both have backpacks and all kinds of knickknacks on. It was cute. I liked the logo. I liked the colors. And I really liked the characters. So I thought, I'll try it. This isn't a book that I normally enjoy. It's certainly a girl's type comic. But one girl is... Her father has a donut stand, and they're in some type of a carnival, you know, art show or whatever. And her father's out doing things. She wants to leave, and comes to find out the girl can influence people. I guess she could stick her hands out and tell people what to think. And she doesn't want to be at the donut shop. All these people are waiting in line to get donuts. So she says, "Listen up, fools. You're no longer in love with my dad's amazing donuts, even the cinnamon toast donut. You are now in love with greasy, slimy gopher pops." Immediately, the people all have hearts in their eyes, and they think about so totally. The greasier, the better. And there's a woman sleeping, and she has a stand called Gopher Pops. And all of a sudden, Jiminy Cricket, everybody's over there wanting gopher pops, and that's it. They're frozen gophers on a stick. and so the girl basically goes online on her phone. And then her friend shows up. And they pull out a zine. They're talking about people they like. Talking about singers that they like. It takes you away. It's fun. It basically took me into a world that I wasn't with. Oh, also, the girl, she's selling her zines for $1, and all of her zines are gone. Then she ends up, they're running around doing all the carnival stuff. Somehow she convinces people to fall in love with a girl's hat, and they all take it. She finds a friend of the zines, find out what happened to the zines. Her friend plays guitar for a bunch of people, gets upset because the girl influences them to like her song. And then they walk away as friends. Also, what surprised me is the girl with the guitar has a crush on somebody that they have class with. Come to find out it's another girl. And that surprised me. We come from a different generation, but they're openly talking about, you know, same sex, you know, things, which was always taboo before. I was really surprised. I liked it. I would never buy another one. Even if it was in the dollar box. But I mean, when I say that, it's fantastic. I'm just not the audience for it. But, you know, if my daughter liked this, I would read hers. You know, it's well done. Fantastic imagination. And I am a big proponent saying that we need diversity in comics. It can't all be the same thing. And this is certainly its own animal. And this is 204. And I was looking this up after I read it. I mean, I said that I do like it. But there's a lot of this stuff. So I just was never with it. But I like the graphic design to it. I like all the lettering. I like the back cover. Fantastic stuff. Anyway, so that's that for this section. And let's take another music break.
どんなにごまかしても、どんなに疑って。 もそこに映るもの何もなくて計り知れない想いを嘘っぱちじゃない願いを本当はきっとね求めている変わらなくていいもんだって飾らなくていいんだよなんてそばにある安らかな願いを君がくれた温かい曇りまだそれがここにあるのなら優しさに変えてく力を今どこで信じよう
Tomi, she's from Japan, and she's one of my favorites.
Right on.
Now, one thing we were talking about, we started and we got off topic, which we tend to do all the time, is the Archie book from Craig Yeo that Al's got. During the music break, I was looking through it, and I thought, man, I want to talk about this some more. I thought it was a Bob Montana book, because the end papers, like I said, we described that drawing. But, man, it's so much more. It has a write-up about Harry Lucy, one of my favorites,
Sam Schwartz.
Yeah, I haven't seen the Dan DiCarlo thing, but it's got original artwork. It's got I've never seen a picture of Sam Schwartz.
Me neither, or Harry Lucy.
I haven't seen that one yet. But
when
I'm seeing this, I'm looking at it, and I'm going to buy it. It's got Little Archie in it. And one thing, besides, you know, showing the stories and the artwork and all that, they got sections of the book. Like, they have the records you could get off cereal boxes. They have a page of bubblegum stuff. I didn't know that they had Archie comics in bubblegum, like the Bazooka Joe. And it looks it was formatted exactly like Bazooka Joe. I'm guessing that was the company. But there were Archie comics in it. They had,
with Archie buttons there.
Yeah, they have the buttons, and they have,
Oh, yeah, I never saw these. The Archie gum cards, I never saw that.
No, they had, when my daughter was small in the early 90s, they had Archie gum cards. She had some of them. They were drawn by Dan DiCarlo, but they weren't really so much by that time.
These are neat, these little, like, you know, rectangular comics.
Those came out of cereal boxes.
Yeah, I bet they did, yeah, in the 50s.
Because Captain Crunch had some of those, Quisp and Quake cereal had some of those, and there was another, it was kind of like a Czech cereal, and it was some English guy. And when it came out, it was in 66. And I was living in Colorado at the time, and they always came in with those long rectangular comic books of that character. They also have, I asked Al if he had any, and gum machines, they used to have little itty-bitty tiny comic books.
I had the Marvel ones.
Yeah, they had Marvel ones, which I remembered. I never really quite saw the Archies.
I never saw the Archies either.
But I had one, and they came apart really easy. But they were basically black and white, but the cover had one color on it, and it wasn't over the character.
Archie match cover.
Yeah, it was a match book.
I was smoking reading Archie, that's nice.
Yeah. You know, I was in the Navy. A lot of guys would collect matchbooks wherever we went. You know, Australia, Korea. It was kind of neat.
Yeah, there's all sorts of merchandising here, which I'd never seen. I don't remember bologna bubble gum.
That's what I was saying. That was the like the Bazooka Joe time. But those are the cereal box records. I like it when
these are cereal box records.
Yeah, you could get them off. I think Honeycomb. But that was the back of the box, and when you finished the cereal,
you play them?
Yeah, they had a.
I never saw those, man.
It wasn't.
You cut them, and then you play them on your turntable.
Yeah, because they had a plastic coating over that section. You know, not the rest of the cereal box, just that. And kids would bring them into school. I was in second grade, so that was 68 and 69. But they had the Jackson 5 on Alphabets in 72. And Bobby Sherman was on Honeycomb. I'm thinking 70 or 71. The Monkees were on, I don't know what cereal, Alphabets, I think.
Oh, my God.
But they were on cereal boxes in, like, 69. It wasn't just, you know, one or two, but the Archies was the first, well...
Look at that. Look at the calendars. Oh, I never saw these before.
But when the cartoon came out, you could get those songs on the cereal boxes. You know, the songs have been out a while. They weren't brand new songs. Well, they were fairly new. But sometimes kids would bring in, that was the animated cartoon from Filmation, and they got model sheets. But they had, some kids would bring those cereal box records, and you could tell that they cut them out with a dull knife.
Oh, no.
But they bring it for show and tell, and the teacher let them play them on the little record player there. It still played, even though the edges were frayed.
Yeah, did you ever see this? They actually, I think it's Harry Lucy did, like, an Archie story about, like, his cousin was, like, a...
Private Eye.
Yeah, the Private Eye. Yeah,
I thought that was Bob Montana.
I think it's Harry Lucy.
But what was neat about that was...
Or maybe it is Bob Montana. I don't know.
Yeah, well, it could be here. I thought they were all Bob Montana when I was looking through it. But that's drawn like...
Oh, Harry Lucy did it, okay. Yeah. Harry Lucy.
It looks like Archie is Steve Canyon, you know, drawn by Milton Caniff.
Yeah.
Oh, look at that. I've never seen that. And, I mean, it's crisp. It's nice. And then all of a sudden, it shows Archie and Miss Grundy and the rest of them in between telling the story. Harry Lucy was the real deal.
He actually drew, like, you know, like Sam Hill and Black Hood. He did, he did superhero comics.
Yeah.
He could easily, he became, like, one of the classic Archie artists.
Well,
that's fantastic.
He was comfortable in both worlds. And on that one, sometimes Gene Colan was...
He could do it, too.
He could do it, but people would criticize him after drawing Howard the Duck so long that when he went to draw Batman... He was shorthanding people's hands where they looked like, you know, just three. And, you know, John Byrne was saying that in 82, and Gary Groff published all the examples in the Comics Journal, and all the things he said were correct. You know, but Harry Lucy, he didn't lose it. He didn't get so comfortable with Archie that he couldn't go back.
I just love looking at old Archie covers or comic book covers. They're so simple and to the point. You know, and they're cartoony, but they're also realistic, too. You know what I mean? It's like there's a... They had a great balance. Yeah, balancing cartooning and realism. You know, they had the right...
Yeah. And when I see Archie's, that's what I always think is those covers. Was that...
Yeah, look how simple that is.
Yeah.
How perfect it is.
It is perfect. And they were unique. And, of course, I say that. I love the Dan DiCarlo covers that came in the 70s.
Yeah, me too.
Who's the artist that did a lot of those covers?
That's DiCarlo.
Oh, it is DiCarlo.
Some of these other ones look like Sam Schwartz and DiCarlo did them. Yeah. That's definitely DiCarlo. I mean, that's like a classic early 60s comic book.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, oh my God, it's beautiful. That's a fantastic book.
It is a well, I'm going to buy it. That's a celebration of America's famous favorite teenagers. That's nice. That's really sweet. All right. And now it's time for...
Palooza!
All right,
here it is, the bag.
We only have one pile in this house because I didn't come prepared for it.
So there you go, buddy.
All right.
Grab a funny.
So I'm pulling right out from the center. This is a stick. Oh.
Oh.
Oh, wow. Okay, this is the Dell Giant Comic Tarzan's Jungle Annual, and it's 25 cents, and it's square bound. I didn't know Dell did books like that.
Oh, Jesse Marsh, too.
Well, the first thing that catches me is the Juicy Fruit ad on the back. Vacation time is all too short. Don't lose part of your vacation by having an accident. Be smart, play safe. That's really nice. All right. Painted cover on the front that looks like a children's coloring book.
That's all.
Oh, it is Jerry.
Yeah, Jesse pretty much Marsh. All Jesse Marsh. Yeah.
Wow. Jesse Marsh is someone I didn't know until I got to know Al, and now I love him.
I remember seeing his work when I was young and just kind of indistinguishable from other artists, but then I remember like artists writing about him, and then when I picked up the book, some of his figures. It reminded me in a weird way of Richard Corbin. Like, Corbin looked at his work, and I think he was very influenced by it.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, okay, this isn't nice. And the more I looked at it, it's simplistic and sometimes crude, but it's effective. You know what I mean? The design is there. The blacks and the blacks and whites are spotted nicely, and it seems like he was, a lot of times he was very strong drawing animals, so the animal work is unbelievable in some of these books.
Well, with Jesse Marsh, I said this before, he's like there's an honesty to his work.
Yeah.
But he didn't spend any time on the finishes.
No.
It almost looks like, and when I say this, I love these, like thumbnail sketches that some artists do.
Exactly.
And
exactly, yeah.
It didn't seem like he went further from that.
Because imagine you have to draw this entire book in a regular issue of in a month.
Yeah, because he's a no frills. Now, I would have liked a little more embellishing on it, but
might have ruined it.
Yeah, what Al says is right. The placement is there, the drawing is there,
the design is there.
The pages, the panels, everything is just laid out. This is the textbook on what you should do, and he's not putting in any after effects or special effects on it. What you see is what you get. But
he was a Disney artist. He was a Disney animator.
Oh, really?
Went to comics.
But you can see that he didn't have much time. But I'll tell you, at the same time, he still put in some unique things. Like I said, the John Carter work, the Martians, it looked like he was drawing off of Peruvian culture, you know, quickly. But it wasn't like he just used stock figures for everything. Yeah, this is sweet. Did you buy this when you were a kid?
No. I probably got it like 10 years ago somewhere.
The Game of Hazards.
And that's like from the 50s, I think.
Yeah, but just the drawings on this is neat. The headshots. The Dell comics, you know, they were done for kids, so they'd always have activity pages in between. This is a... Let's see, this Jesse Marsh, the lines are thicker. This is more like early Joe Kubert.
Yeah, I'm just guessing. I'm not looking at the book. I'm guessing it's all Jesse Marsh. It's possible he was inked by somebody else, or he decided to change his tools just to give it a different look from keep him getting bored.
So this story here, the second, well, it's not the second, it's the one I'm talking about, Desert Ambush. This one has more of a Alex Toth finish to it, which I like. The line's a little thicker. When I said earlier about I wish you would have put a little more embellishment to it, maybe this one, it has just enough that I'm happy with it. But it looks like some of the Alex Toth.
Alex Toth was slick. You know what I mean? This is like Alex Toth, like you said, rough drawings, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. But when I say that, I am a big fan of Justin Marsh. God, this story here is something as well.
And trust me, in this book here, which I just had here, the Zorro book, you can see Alex Toth doing it really quick, and you can see that some of it isn't totally delineated.
I love his Zorro
book. I love it, though. You can see that he was cranking some of these out. You know what I mean? It's like, this page is almost all headshots if you take a look at it. But the people are posing.
Yeah, but even though they're headshots, it's not just talking heads.
It's not boring.
Yeah, I mean, he put the same effort. I mean, those are fantastic.
You can see, like, that face and some of these faces. Jesse Marsh, definitely, but yeah.
Yeah, he did, Alex Toth did Zorro for Dell Comics as well. And they put them out in these really nice black and white volumes. I've got one, and I'm guessing they added gray tones to some.
Yeah, they added gray tones,
and that just helped it. But they look fantastic in black and white. I don't really know what I think about in color, but this one, God, this is
it's a big book. It's like 100 pages or something.
Yeah, it's a big, thick, square-bound book, and the cover stock is really heavy. It looks like a coloring book.
Yeah, it does look like a coloring book, doesn't it?
Yeah, but you know, if I was a kid, I probably wouldn't have gone for it because of the cover, but the interiors, it's...
This is from 56. This is before I
was
born.
Well, we weren't even around.
All right, I'll pull a book from my...
I'll tell you, 56, 25 cents is a lot of money. I was wondering
why... straight it was.
You know, that's a thick, thick book, and it's stocked full, but...
I'll pull this one out here. The Last Days of Pompeii.
Plastics Illustrated.
I believe this might be Kirby. I'm not sure. Oh, yeah.
Really?
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
The Classics Illustrated are I've never liked them. Al and I kind of differ on them. I read that they came from England.
Gilberton? I don't know.
But what I was told before was the Classics Illustrated, you could only get them in schools.
No, I saw them on the stands.
Well, I saw them in the stands in the 70s. They had them once in a while, but I think way back in the beginning, you could only get them at school. I'm guessing before my time, because I never really saw them at school.
Now, this says... this was from the 60s. It says 1970, but no way, this is from the 60s.
There was... it might have been a reprint.
Probably. Yeah, they reprinted a lot.
Because I do remember these when I was a kid in the 70s. They had these in the stands, but they didn't look any different.
I saw them all the time. Yeah, like Jekyll and Hyde and Frankenstein.
Oh, this is originally from 1947. But
don't think that's from 47. That Kirby art looks 60s to me. It doesn't look old.
Because it said they printed it in... Yeah, this is the 40s.
No, this is 60s Kirby. Early 60s Kirby.
Maybe that's just at the beginning. It says at the beginning... Gilbertson Company Incorporated, 1947 spring, 1970 issue. I guess 47 is when they started.
They started, and this is probably like a reprint from 70. That's nice, man. I don't know who inked it, but it's nice.
It is nice. The printing on it, though, is kind of muddled.
Yeah, it's not sharp. It's not sharp.
Yeah, but Charlton Comics always had that kind of look to it. The interiors.
Because they printed their own.
Yeah, but they were kind of dull and, the covers were not, but the
interiors. The covers weren't, no.
Yeah, this is nice. I like this. This is Jack Kirby. Yeah. The finishes don't look like it.
No, I don't know who the inker was. It's not Dick Ayers, but...
The inker's using a really thin line, but this is... Wow, and I like how he drew the women, because they look kind of like those Greek vase drawings, some of them. Wow, this is nice. Okay, this is a good pull. I don't like the cover, but the interiors I do like.
I don't know who painted the cover, but...
This is really neat. Okay, well, I take it back. I found the classics illustrated I like.
There's a few of them. George Evans did a few. Reed Crandall did a few. But a lot of them were okay. Yeah, just do one more.
All right, one more. I'm pulling from the center again.
One more for the road. Not in your line.
Elvira's Haunted Holiday.
There you go. All right. DC started doing these Elvira comics in the early 80s for about a year. I guess that's when her show was being syndicated all over. So she was a big... She still is a big deal, but she was like, you know, everybody knew about her then. And DC jumped in on the bandwagon. And I guess, is it House of Secrets or is it...
It just says, House of Mystery Presents.
Haunted Holiday, House of Mystery Presents. Oh, man. Beautiful. 87. Beautiful Dan Springer art on the cover, on the first page, anyway.
Now, this one, Elvira, they used to have a show called Entertainment Tonight. It was syndicated, and I used to watch it. And they were talking about, this is in 82. And they were talking about 3D. They were starting to show 3D movies like Creature of the Black Lagoon and stuff. And you could go to 7-Eleven and buy your glasses. And they were carrying on about how 3D was making a comeback. It was fun. And then they showed Elvira. And I said, who is that? You know, I thought, wow, that's something. They didn't show her where I lived. No, but they, every once in a while they would show a clip on Entertainment Tonight where she would talk, and I guess for the 3D they had her and two other guys wearing the glasses and says TV and 3D, and why aren't they showing her? And then I went to the Navy, and one of the guys in my ship was always getting cards from people, and it was Elvira in the cover. You know her? Yeah, they show her. You know, she was the monster host in Los Angeles. And of course after that you couldn't get away from her. She was everywhere. And then this comic came out. And then she came, I remember there was a teenage show called Saved by the Bell on television. And on NBC one night, they had a monster movie, and she hosted it, and the kids from Saved by the Bell were with her. And it was funny because...
I never saw that.
You couldn't help but look away. I was just flipping channels, and I started watching it. And it had all these kids from Saved by the Bell with her, because they weren't quite kids anymore. It was towards the end of the show. But... It was one of those 50s radioactive monster, you know, insects or whatever. They grew giant. But when it switched back to them, Elvira made a comment about that kid that was the main character in the movie. Says she made a bag on the kid actor, and he never went anywhere. And then she stopped and looked around and goes, well, that won't happen to you. I don't know. It was funny. I didn't realize that she would act that way. This is a nice artwork.
That's Frank Springer doing really, really nice Elvira art.
Frank Springer is somebody that I loved and hated at the same time.
He could be very good, and he could also, like, you know, crank it out too.
Yeah. I've seen work he's done. And I thought that was fantastic. Jack Sparling, you talked.
There's
about
another guy. I love him now, but that was a love hate in the past.
Yeah,
he did so much work though. He was a guy that really was like. I think he was one of the go-to guys, like a Sal Buscema type, you know. But now, always solid layouts. And
I look at it. I don't particularly like it, but I see the skill in it. But yeah, he was just cranking it out. I'm sure I've seen a lot of his work that I thought was good. This one says by Barbara Randall and Stephen DeStefano.
Yeah, Stephen DeStefano did a humor book. And I can't remember what his name.
Amazing Man.
That's it. Amazing Man. Yeah.
Which is a really popular book for a while. But I don't remember it being drawn like this. Wow, I like... Who drew this? Twas the Night Before Xmas.
Oh, it looks like the X-Men.
Yeah, X-Men. Oh, Christmas Tree, there's another one. Just one page. Well, I never bought these. These are... okay, I remember when these came out. This was 87.
I don't know who drew that.
Yeah, it looks like, sort of, like somebody trying to draw like Von Bode.
There's Elvira there.
It never says who drew it. Yeah, there's Elvira at the end, drawn by Paul Gulacy.
Paul Gulacy?
Paul Gulacy.
Well, that doesn't look like his work at all. Huh.
Is he still around?
Oh, no. The Elvira is a Paul Gillespie. I don't
know. No, that's what I'm saying. Not this one.
Yeah, I'm trying to find out who did this. No, doesn't anybody want to take credit for it?
I liked it.
I can't tell. Gillespie's still doing work, yeah. He's still around.
I haven't seen him in a long time.
He's probably doing an independent book or something like that. But, yeah, that's a fun book. They did a few of these. He had a regular DC book, and then Harris Comics picked her up and did a cover. Yeah, she still shows up every Halloween. A couple of years ago, she came back and did, like, 13 episodes. They were on the CW, and hopefully she comes back again. So.
Yeah, she keeps going. Coming on.
She's an icon.
Yeah, I agree.
And that cover's by Garcia Lopez, so it's really nice.
Yeah, he was the bomb.
All right, well, let's just end it there. You know,
we've been going on for a while. Anyway, it's 2017. I hope everybody enjoyed the new year and made it through fine. And if you're listening to the show and you like it, please rate us, review us, or even subscribe to us on iTunes. It really helps us out. And if you like the show, please tell one of your friends. Anyway, thanks for listening. In the meantime,
read more comics.
You can find Al's other podcast, Slow Robot A Go-Go, Dallas's webcomic, The Mighty Blue, and Al's blog, Destination Nightmare, on the sidebar of our blog at bunchofdorks.com.
And click on the Cyclops!